If any. Okay, that's kind of what I expected. This talk is going to be focused on Microsoft Test Manager 2012, but I will go back for those of you that haven't used Microsoft Test Manager before, and I'll show you some of the core capabilities that we shipped in Microsoft Test Manager 2010, just to kind of set expectations so that we're all on the same page before we show the new stuff. So my name is Brian Keller. I work at Building 40 on Microsoft's Redmond campus. If you're ever in town, I'll buy you lunch. To this day, nobody's actually taken me up on that, so maybe someday I'll have to buy a few thousand lunches in the fullness of time, but that's great with me. I've been on Visual Studio for just shy of 10 years, so next week is actually my 10-year anniversary, so that's exciting. I'm on Channel 9. On my blog, I post all of my content, my PowerPoint presentations, links to other times that I've delivered similar sessions, recordings, that kind of thing. And I also make available my virtual machines. So everything that I'm going to be showing up here, you can go back and download the release candidate virtual machine of Visual Studio 2012. That comes pre-configured with Team Foundation Server 2012, with sample data, with what else? With 18 hands-on labs. And the lion's share of those are actually focused on software testing. So if you want to get started doing formal test case management, exploratory testing, it's a good way to kind of dive in a sandboxed environment without having to spin up your own TFS and new projects and all that good stuff. And the other nice thing about it being virtualized, of course, is that if you mess something up, you can always restore back to a snapshot and do it again. So I've written a couple of books. I can finally actually announce that my buddy Martin and I, back there, we just are working, wrapping up the Visual Studio 2012 version of these books as well. So they should be on Amazon and rocks.com pretty soon for you to go out and buy if you want. And let's dive right into it. So the first thing that I'm going to do is take you through formal test case management with Microsoft Test Manager. And that's the lion's share of what we introduced in 2010. And then from there, we're going to also show exploratory testing as well. How many people, just show of hands, are doing exploratory testing today? No? A few of you? Okay. So all the exploratory testing guys are down here, and formal testing must be over here. That's funny how that worked out. So we'll show the two different approaches and how the tool set has kind of evolved to support both of those approaches. And then I'll also show you some lab management demos. And if you keep your fingers crossed, my Windows 8 connectivity will remain active, and I'll be able to show you the new testing support we have for building and testing Metro-style applications, which is really, really quite cool. I'm pretty excited to be able to show that to you. So I always like to kind of remind us of why quality is important. So here are some fun examples. The USS Yorktown was one of the first ships that they converted to be a smart ship. And of course, anytime you use a label like that, you know you're asking for trouble. So unfortunately, one of the first times they launched this ship, a crew member entered a zero in one of the text boxes, and it shut down the entire ship with a divide by zero. It was dead in the water for about 3 hours. So I really don't want to be the poor crew member that did that. I really don't want to be the tester responsible for testing that functionality. To pick on, pick on Europe a little bit. This is the Ariane 4. The Ariane 5. They reused a lot of code from the Ariane 4, and unfortunately, they didn't test that for the new flight path, and that ended up costing the rocket about $500 million mistake in 1996 prices. If you like these kinds of examples, I recommend a talk from OSCON a few years ago called "An Illustrated History of Failure." And during that presentation, the speaker goes through and he attempts to quantify the value of a human life in terms of, you know, the average GDP for a country divided by the number of people and the working years and that sort of thing. And he comes up with a value of something like $2 million is the value of each of our lives on average. And due to the magic of software, he concludes that it's possible to eradicate the value of your life and thousands of your peers just by having a single bug in your code. So my goal with these presentations is to make sure that none of us show up in a future version of that presentation. And this is my newest addition to this set of examples. I was actually recently in Stockholm, and they have this beautifully restored ship called the Vasa. And the Vasa sank in the early 17th century, I believe, on its maiden voyage about a nautical mile off of the just out of the port. And the problem with the Vasa is that, number one, they had a late-breaking requirement here where they added this extra row of cannons. And, of course, that created a situation where the boat ended up being very top-heavy. So they didn't go through the proper change request procedures. Where have we seen that before? Because they should have added more ballast down here. But the real problem here is that they actually did test the boat. They had sailors on the top deck running from one side to the other and back and back. And what they noticed was that the boat was listing very heavily. And the guy running the test said, whoa, 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 you have to stop this test because if you do it one more time, you're going to sink the boat. And they said, hey, our test failed. We can't sail this boat. Unfortunately, QA was ignored. And so they sailed the boat, and of course, we know what happened next. So those are some good examples from history. Of course, I work for the largest software developer in the world, so I would be remiss not to mention some of our own mistakes. This is a product I worked on. I'm not quite sure how you would go ahead and close that dialogue. This file is still copying. This is my favorite. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. What's wrong with that? Of course, we're missing a period at the end. Otherwise, the dialogue's fine, right? And just, okay. So I love those examples. So what do we do about it? Well, when we set out for the Visual Studio 2010 journey a few years ago, we knew that we wanted to make a major investment in quality, and we knew that we wanted to grow the Visual Studio family of products to really address quality in a new way. And so we looked at this from a few different angles. The first way I like to look at this is by comparing it to a hobby that I enjoy, which is rock climbing and mountain climbing. And when you get out and start doing rock climbs and mountain climbs, then you start in the gym and you start doing some conditioning, and then eventually you go out and you have your big climb. And when you're in the gym and you jam your finger and, you know, maybe you're out of the gym for a couple of days, the cost of failure is really, really low. But when you're out on the Glacier Peak, like I am here, you can probably see in the background there's a hailstorm that was about to hit us about 20 minutes after this photo was taken. At that point, you're really hoping that you tested yourself, your gear, your escape plan, all that good stuff, because the cost of failure is much, much higher. Well, the same is true in software, right? I mean, if we can give you the tools in Visual Studio so that you can F5 and find a bug right away, you're going to fix that. Maybe the cost to you is 5 or 10 minutes of your time because you know what you did. Worst case, you can just press undo a few times and you're back to where you started. But if you wait until you get out to release to find this bug, we've all seen the data, right? It's 10 or 100 times more expensive, especially if you start crashing rocket ships and things like that. So we knew that we really wanted to invest not only in the development phase, but also in the test phase as well. And of course, Visual Studio for the last 15 years has been investing in the development phase. So we knew that the next best thing we could do is invest in the test part of the life cycle as well. So we looked at all the activities that make up software testing. And you can figure out where you sit on this spectrum. So at the far right end of the spectrum, you have specialist coders. These are in the Microsoft parlance, we would call these software development engineers in test. These are people who write code which tests other code. Maybe you're writing unit tests. Maybe you're writing load tests. You can imagine what else you might be writing, functional tests. And then at the far left end of the spectrum, we have people that are doing manual testing. So these are people that wake up every day, they follow along with a script, and here's a test case you need to run, here's a new build, you need to go back and rerun those test cases. And what we found is that about 70% of software testing, regardless of the organization size you look at, was still manual testing, and probably will be, probably forever if I had to guess, just because humans are much better at catching bugs than computers tend to be. And they're also more robust at being able to change things as software is evolving over time. Now, of course, eventually, once things get to be more stable, you can write some automated tests. We think there's certainly a place for that. But what we found is that the majority of the existing tools on the market, whether it's open source tools or other vendor tools, are already pretty well serving that particular portion of the market. So we really wanted to focus on this end of the spectrum, help make manual testers more productive in what they do. Now, software is not just an individual sport, it's built in the team. And so the other thing that is no surprise to any of us is that when a tester finds a bug, and they send it over to the developer, something like this happens. Developer takes a look at that and says, you know what, it works on my machine. I've been on both sides of that equation. And what's actually going on there? Well, chances are both people are probably correct. Chances are the tester did find a bug in their environment, and the developer probably ran the test, and it worked well in his environment. But what's actually happening there? Well, it could be that, you know, Martin interpreted the test case differently, or he's running last week's build, or any number of things are happening. You know, I've seen problems where Martin maybe is on a 64-bit machine and I'm on a 32-bit machine. And that's great that we can kind of have that conversation, but we have to go back and forth. We have to play this game of ping pong to try to figure out exactly what went wrong. And so the knee-jerk reaction that we see in a lot of organizations is they say, okay, Martin, next time you find a bug, you need to fill out this 40-page report and tell us exactly what you're doing and attach screenshots and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So now when Martin's looking at the clock and he says, well, it's almost 5 o'clock. I just found a bug. I don't know. Is it really important enough to fill out this 40-page report? Probably not. Well, that's not the right behavior. So we wanted to make sure that the tool itself automatically captures all this information and surfaces it in an actionable way for developers to quickly understand, diagnose, and eventually fix the issue. Okay, so those are the three goals we have. One is to drive that quality upstream. Two is to make manual testers very productive at what they do. And then three is to make sure that the developers and the testers can play well together at the end of the day. So with the Visual Studio 2010 lineup, we introduced a new member of the family, which is still in Visual Studio 2012, called Visual Studio Test Professional. And Visual Studio Test Professional is what you would buy if you wanted to just get Microsoft Test Manager. With Visual Studio 2010, you would also get that with Visual Studio Ultimate. In Visual Studio 2012, we're also giving Microsoft Test Manager to anybody who has Visual Studio Premium as well. We also introduced this lab management thing that we'll talk about later. Originally, we announced that as a separate product, but in the end, we ended up making that just a core component of Team Foundation Server. So if you have Team Foundation Server 2010 or 2012, and you have Microsoft Test Manager via any of those aforementioned vehicles, then you can start working with lab management. The other thing that I'll talk about is the hosted service. So in this room, right after this talk, Martin's going to be talking about the Team Foundation service. And if you caught the announcement this morning from Scott Guthrie, he announced that we just opened that up to everybody. So we used to have this TFS preview that required an invitation code. We're still in preview right now, but you don't need an invitation code. You can go to tfspreview.com, and you can sign up right away, and you can get briankeller.tfspreview.com. So with that, you can start storing all of your test cases, and you can start doing manual testing within Team Foundation Server or the Team Foundation Service. The one thing we don't support yet in the hosted version of Team Foundation Service is lab management. Okay? So let's dive in and do some demos. So this is the virtual machine that I was talking about. So this contains all the sample data if you want to go back and try this at home. So what I've done is I've connected to Microsoft Test Manager, which is a tool that we built from the ground up specifically for testers. So this is for manual testers or test leads. And what I'll do to start with is I'll show you the formal test case management approach that we're using here. So with formal test case management, you usually start with one or more requirements. And so this is a list of requirements that the development team is going to be implementing in this particular iteration. And then over on the right-hand side, you see a list of all of the test cases that we've written in order to validate that that functionality is behaving correctly. And so if I take a look at one of those test cases, you'll see that it's just a work item within Team Foundation Server. So it has a title up there at the top. And then if I scroll down, you'll notice that it has this custom control, which gives us the ability to list the individual test steps. So nothing fancy here. There's just a couple of things that are interesting to point out. One is this Twitter-style syntax here, where we say new quantity. What we're doing with that is basically allowing you to data bind that to this parameter values table down below. So for this particular test case, what we're doing is we're making sure that for a shopping cart, if the user goes in and types the letter A, and tries to refresh the page, it shouldn't crash the shopping cart. If they try to, you know, make us pay them to shop with us by typing -5, obviously that's a failing business model. We want to test for that one as well. The other thing that you'll notice here is that in a few of these steps, we also have what's called an expected result. That's just telling the tester exactly what to expect, and it will actually require that they mark that particular test step as pass or fail, as you'll see in a minute. And then finally, that's it. So what I'll do now is just go ahead and run that particular test case by switching over to my test activity. And you'll see that I have this test case actually showing up a couple of different times in this list. The reason for that is that we have a test matrix defined, which says that for each one of these test cases, I want you to test it on both a Windows Server 2008 environment and a Windows 7 environment. And you can define however many test matrices you want. You could say, I want to test it with this version of a third-party library and that other version of a third-party library. Whatever you need for your particular environment, you can define that. And so I'm on a Windows Server machine, so I will just say, let's run this test. And this launches what's called Microsoft Test Runner. A lot of you have probably worked with this. And so at this point, what I can do is I can say Start Test. And one of the nice things here is that I've run this test before, so we have what's called an action recording that I can take advantage of. And so what I'm doing here, I know it's hard to see, but I'm highlighting the first few test steps. And the action recording allows me to do a few things. Number one is it allows me to fast forward through my test case, and that can oftentimes save me a lot of time as a tester. So if I just click play, it's going to quickly click through the application and bring me up to the point that's interesting for me as a manual tester to do some validation. So imagine I had a 20-step test case, and the first few steps were create a new user, log in, add this item to your shopping cart. And really what I'm testing today is this shopping cart functionality where we have a CAPTCHA on the very last page. Well, I don't want to have to go through the first 18 steps every single time, so this can help you be more productive as a manual tester. At this point, it's asking me to validate that functionality. I'll go ahead and say that's fine. We'll pass that, and we'll close the test. So pretty straightforward. And then we can end that iteration and move to the next iteration, which is going to ask me to test the next row of data. So the number 0, the -5, and so on. So that's pretty straightforward. We'll go ahead and close out of there. Notice that we passed that particular test result, so it's showing up at the bottom of the list here. For those of you that use Microsoft Test Manager 2010, one of the features that a lot of people asked us for is the ability to just quickly mark whether or not a test case was passed or failed. And you can do that now straight from Test Manager without having to jump into Test Runner just by clicking Fail Test or Pass Test. And that's really nice if you happen to know, hey, I just saw that this functionality is broken on another person's machine. Trust me, I know it's broken. We'll go ahead and mark it as pass or fail, right? You can also mark things as blocked. So if you know that a particular test case doesn't work because you need to sign in as a user but you can't create users now, well, you can go ahead and block a test case, and then you can reevaluate that with future builds to see whether or not you need to run those. So that should help testers be more productive at running tests. But there's another thing that testers do all the time, which is evaluate new builds that are coming out, especially in a world of continuous build where you may be building, you know, 5 or 500 times a day. As a test team, how do I know when is the right time to pick up a new build? Obviously, I can't pick up 500 builds a day. That wouldn't be worth my time. And so what testers resort to is establishing someone on the development team that they can go talk to and say, hey, you know, have you checked in that feature? What did you change in this release? That sort of thing. But again, that's not a great use of the developer or the tester's time if they constantly have to open up that communication channel. The nice thing is that because we're storing all this data in TFS, TFS can actually start to answer some of those questions for you. So if I move over to my track activity and say assign build, this is going to give me a list of all the builds that have been created since the last time I selected a build for my test plan. And so, quite simply, the current build I'm testing with is 3.18.3, and there's this new build available, which is 3.18.4. Now, down here in the list below, this grid is basically showing me all of the work items that a developer has associated with check-ins that are available in this build. Okay? So here I'm looking at a particular task which is closed, has something to do with a regular expression. That doesn't necessarily mean anything to my test plan. So I'm probably going to skip this build. It's not really worth my time to go install this. But if I look at the next build, Now you can see it gets to be a little bit more interesting. Now we have this user story that's resolved. We have a few more tasks that are being checked in. And then finally, if I look at the latest build, you'll notice that I also have this bug that's resolved. So the process I follow on my team is if a developer says I resolved this bug, we also want the QA team to go back and validate that they can no longer reproduce it. So at this point, this build looks like it's worth my time. I can pick this up. I can assign it to my plan, which then signals to the rest of the test team, this is the build we're testing with now. And that way, any of the test results that you capture as you're running your tests, they'll automatically be filed in TFS and all of your reports against that particular build. But that's only half the question. That tells me some new things that I can go test that were either blocked before or maybe bugs that I was waiting to see if I can regress anymore. It doesn't answer the question of, hey, I had like 500 tests that I ran over the last week, and all of those tests passed. Well, now the developers maybe checked in some new code which broke some of those tests, and I don't quite know where to dig in. I can't test 500 tests before I leave today. And so, once again, traditionally, testers might go to developers and say, well, what did you change? What do you think I should retest in my test plan? Did you change the shopping cart functionality? And, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a developer who remembers what they changed, they may not always know how that correlates to your test plan. And even if they did, that's yet another time that you're distracting one team or another. And so one of the technologies we introduced in 2010 is called test impact analysis. And test impact analysis can be turned on when you're testing managed code, so .NET applications. And the way it works is when you run a particular test, so I'm running test case 41, and you are invoking this particular class and then these three methods on this particular class, and then a developer goes back and makes a change to this particular method, it then traverses the tree and says, hey, you should probably think about running test case 41 again. It doesn't mean test case 41 is going to fail, and it doesn't mean that there's not also other test cases that may be failing for different reasons. Maybe there's native code that's changing, or maybe there's external dependencies that are changing that test impact analysis doesn't have access to. But it at least gives you that quick estimate that says if you've got 20 minutes between now and your lunch break and you're testing a new build, this is where you can probably spend your time that's going to give you the highest chance of finding a bug so that you can help the developers fail fast and get that feedback back to them that says, hey, you just regressed some important functionality. And so what I'll do is I'll assign this build to my plan, and now it's going to tell me there's some new tests that you should consider rerunning again based on that test impact analysis data. So I'll say view recommended tests. It's going to come back and say these test cases, the last time you ran them, they passed. And so what I can do is say reset to active. And then when I go back to my test activity, that signals to the testers that they need to consider rerunning those tests. Okay? So everything I just showed you so far is formal test case management. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and show you exploratory testing. With exploratory testing, also sometimes called agile testing, you usually don't start with a test case. You might start with a rough idea of an area you want to test, or as James Whitaker calls it, a charter or a tour. James Whitaker used to be at Google. Actually, he used to be at Microsoft. He helped build this product, and then he went to Google, and then he came back to Microsoft recently. And he's written some great books about exploratory testing. And he basically talks about exploratory testing by comparing it to going on a trip. And so if you were to go to Rome, for example, and you had one day, what are you going to do? You're going to go to the Forum. You're going to go to the Colosseum. That's what everybody does, right? Here's the scripted path to your first time in Rome. But if you go back to Rome and you've got 2 weeks to kill, then you might say, hey, for this, you know, the next 3 days, we're going to try to do a back alley tour. And we're going to go down every back alley that, you know, get off the beaten path and see what we can find. And if I do that, or if Martin does that, or if George does that, we'll probably have three completely different tours that we can get together and discuss. And along the way, we'll discover some interesting things. And exploratory testing is the same way. So you might have a tour where you say, let me pretend, I'll pick on my mom as an example. She doesn't do a lot of online shopping. She's very nervous that her credit card details are going to be stolen or something like that. But she might look at a website like Amazon.com, and she might go peruse their merchandise and say, all right, well, that's what I want to buy. Now I'll go to a physical store and buy it. Well, for someone like my mom, if I was Amazon trying to appeal to her, one way that I might do that is to make sure that on every page I have a link to the privacy policy or a link to a phone number so I can find something and then I can call somebody up and place the order with a human being. And so that might be an exploratory test that you would run or a set of tests where you're pretending to be that persona. Or I could pretend to be my little brother, which is, hey, let's try to insert script injection and see if we can crash this site or whatever. And so those types of charters can really help you guide your exploratory testing experience. The downside of exploratory testing is that if I'm a test manager and I have a tester on my team that wants to start practicing exploratory testing, and they say, hey, I need 3 weeks to go do exploratory testing, how do I know what I'm going to get for that three-week investment? How do I know where they're spending their time? They might be in the middle of an exploratory testing session and they might find a bunch of bugs, but are they going to remember exactly what they were doing when they reproduced those bugs? And that's where a tool like Microsoft Test Manager can really help you out. And so let me jump back over to the test tab, and I'm going to click this new area called Do Exploratory Testing. You can start an exploratory testing session either along the confines of a particular work item and say, I'm testing, say, the shopping cart functionality, or you can just go off the beaten path and click on Explore. And when you click on Explore at this point and I say Start, notice that I don't have a test case because, of course, I'm not telling the tester click by click by click what to do. Instead, I'm trusting the experience and the motivation that the tester has to go out and find those bugs. And so at this point, I'm going to open up a website, and I'll just click around once this website loads. I'll just kind of click through the portal. I'm just looking for anything that might catch my eye as a particular bug. And so, you know, maybe that looks good. Now remember, I might be in this experience for, say, 45 minutes or so before I actually find a bug. And eventually, you know, I'm going to click on a record and decide to go down a different rabbit hole. What happens if I click delete? Well, one thing you'll notice here is that we're actually missing some of the values that we had from the previous page. So we don't see customer here. We don't see created by. And so what I might do is grab a screenshot, and I might annotate that screenshot. Just to make this really clear for the developer that looks at this bug. And then at this point, of course, I want to create a bug. So I'll say delete page is missing some values. Again, this is just a work item within TFS. And what's interesting here is that when I file a bug using an exploratory testing session, notice it captured everything that I did here. I clicked on this record, that record, this record. Well, I'm pretty sure that the first, you know, five or six records I clicked on had nothing to do with this. And so what I might choose to do is actually scope the particular actions that I performed down to the ones that I think are going to be most interesting to the developer. And to do that, I just click on Change Steps. And I'm going to say, you know, I clicked on the dashboard, and I clicked on that record. And now it's going to scope that down to that set of information, and I can file that bug. And it's going to include that particular screenshot, and hopefully the developer can take a look at that and say, yes, I know what's happening right away. You may have noticed actually when the test session started, I could have opted to record video. I could have also recorded audio as well. So I could just be cruising through my test session going, hey, look at this. It doesn't quite look right, which is sometimes a lot faster than having to take time to capture a screenshot and type some notes. So whatever your preference is, we'll support that. But now the other interesting thing here is, let's say that I do file this bug back to the developer, and the developer, you know, receives that bug, and they make a fix. And it works for 3 weeks, and then it breaks again. Well, a common criticism of exploratory testing is, how can we be guaranteed that somebody might go down that path again and stumble across this particular regression? You know, the next time I decide to play my little brother role could be a month from now. But this is obviously some really important functionality. We need to make sure that that delete record does contain all the information that we're expecting it to. And so at this point, what I can do is say, save and create test. Now what this does is it creates a new test case for me. I can say make sure delete contains correct values. And then I can come down here, for those of you that use Microsoft Test Manager today, A lot of you asked us to give you rich text, so yay. So there's rich text for you. We can say, you know, do not click on confirm, delete, whatever, make this look pretty. You get the idea. And at this point, when I save and close this, it stores that test case. We already stored the bug. We're right back to the exploratory testing session. I can keep going at this point, find 10 more bugs. And then once I'm finally done, I can say in that testing session, it's going to store the results of all of my exploratory tests. So as a manager, as a test manager, I can come back here and say, gosh, you know, I let my guys go do exploratory testing, and sure enough, this is what they found by playing this particular role. Clearly, we haven't hardened our site enough against the hacker role or against, you know, Brian's mother role or something like that, right? And so it gives you that kind of traceability and transparency into how exploratory testing is working for you. And then, of course, once we go back to this plan tab, you'll notice there's my test case. And so that way, we can make sure that we test this as a formal part of our effort moving forward, so that if we happen to have a regression later on, we'll actually find that. So hopefully that gives you some ideas for you how you might be able to combine the best of both worlds between both formal testing and exploratory testing. Now, let me pause right there and see if there's any questions before I get on to the next session. Yes? Yes. Okay, so his question is how meaningful is that information in that particular test step? Well, you're right. That may not mean anything. I may need to go back and augment that by saying before you get there, you need to open this website or go to the staging site. I might need to massage that data a little bit. And also, your mileage is going to vary based on the type of application and whether or not those controls have names. So when I first started putting together this demo, for example, I discovered that the way we built the HTML application didn't actually have names for the controls. And so I had to go back and make sure that when I was generating the code, I was spitting out control names. And so that's why it's important for you to understand or have that conversation between dev and test to make sure you understand the workflows.
So the 8014105 is the control name?
That's the HTML control name, yeah.
I
didn't. Well, let's pretend the developer named it that. Yeah. So if you would have looked at the list of records, that was the name of the control, or the name of that particular row of data. Yeah. Good question. Yes. Yes. Yeah. What about client-server applications? And so. So this is one of those things that your mileage may vary depending on the type of application you're testing. We actually have a compatibility matrix that shows where you'll be able to get this full, like, you know, list of action logs. It works really well for Microsoft technologies, WPF, Windows Forms, pretty much any HTML or JavaScript application would work. We did a lot of work to support HTML5 in this release. Not 100% of the controls work quite yet. It's an evolving standard. So like the canvas control, you can't exactly tell where you're clicking within the canvas. But for the most part, I think you'll find that if you're building Microsoft applications, that it works pretty well for you, especially rich client applications, because those by definition are required to have unique control names within the control hierarchy. So it works really well there. Where you start to drop off is support for like Java applications, Flash applications. We just don't necessarily have the same ability to get accessibility insights into those. Now, our testing framework is extensible, and we're working with a lot of control vendors so that they can ship the correct shims within their controls to make this light up. So depending on the control vendor that you might use for the applications you build, talk to your control vendor to see if they have support for this. But yes, that's hopefully that answers your question. Yeah. It used to include Silverlight. Unfortunately, right now, we're kind of at a weird spot with Visual Studio 2012. It doesn't support Silverlight right now. They're talking about going back and adding that either by RTM or post-RTM. If you need to test Silverlight, are you using Silverlight 4 or 5? 4, okay. So if you need to test Silverlight 4, what you'll need to do is get Visual Studio 2010 and download what's called the Visual Studio Ultimate Feature Pack 2. Add that to the machines that you're testing on, and that'll give you all the correct support for Silverlight. You also have to build your Silverlight applications with another DLL referenced so that we get that emission. Yeah, that should work once you do that. Okay, yeah?
WPF?
Yes, WPF is supported almost. I'm not aware of any holes there. Yeah, it should work great. Unless you're using custom controls, in which case you need to go get the correct DLLs from your third-party vendors. Okay. If I'm missing anybody, oh, there you are. It's a long room. Hi. Yeah, we do pretty well with multi-threaded applications. You know, occasionally the test automation support that we have needs you to go in and insert delays, for example. Like, what I'm going to do next is actually create a coded UI test based on that action recording, just to give you a taste of that. There's another session that Eric Mano is doing later this week where he's diving deeper into coded UI tests. But generally speaking, the coded UI testing framework is pretty good at understanding when your UI thread is done. So it watches that, and you may have a bunch of stuff going on in the background, and we say, okay, now we think you're done and ready to test. Occasionally, you might have a timer that says, hey, every 15 seconds, we need to sync data. And so you may need to hard code. I'll show you where to do that, hard coded delay. Yeah. Let me jump back in and actually do that just now. So I mentioned the action recordings, and I mentioned how those can have a few different uses, one of which, of course, is to fast forward the manual testing experience. But let's say you've gotten to the point that the application is stabilizing and the manual tests are passing on a regular basis, and you feel like it's time to actually convert a particular manual test into a fully automated coded UI test. Well, coded UI tests are a test type that we introduced in Visual Studio 2010 that allow you to simulate effectively a mouse and a keyboard and a user sitting at that mouse and keyboard going through an application. And so there's a couple of different ways to create them. I can use Visual Basic or C#. Sorry for you J# developers out there. I used to be the J# product manager, so self-deprecating humor there. And when we create this new coded UI test project, it's going to give me a couple of different options for how I create that coded UI test. And the first is to either use an action recording from an existing manual test. So if my manual test team has already done the work of recording that action recording, I can just convert that into code, or I can start interacting with my application the way I expect a user would, and then capturing those actions as I go and converting those directly to code. In this case, I'll show you both approaches. One is, let's start with the existing action recording. I happen to know that that's test case 41. Because these are work items, you can actually use the work item workflow here. There's a status on a manual test case that says automation status, and you can set that to planned. And so that's nice for the manual test team to signal to a software developer, we would like you to consider automating this. It's the point that it's ready to automate. But I happen to know that's the one that's ready to automate. And so now what it does is it goes back and does a few things for me. First, it converted all those actions into code. And so if we take a look at that code, then you'll see where it's opening up the website, it's launching the website, and so on and so forth. And so it's basically just automating exactly what the user was doing when they ran this test. And then it's also automatically data bound this test for me. So if you look up here, it's connecting to this Team Foundation server, it's looking for this work item, it's doing a data access method of sequential. And what that means is that for every row within that particular test case, it's going to run that coded UI test. And so remember, we have three rows of data here. And the nice thing about that is that a manual tester who doesn't necessarily know how to create a coded UI test can still maintain the data and come in here and say, hey, there's actually another value we need to test for. So we've automated, at this point, the experience of a tester clicking through an application, but we haven't automated the tester looking at the application to make sure that it looks correct. And so what we'll do now is add some validation logic. And I happen to know that this is the spot in the test case where the user or the tester usually looks at the application to make sure it's working correctly. And I'll use the coded UI test builder for this. So this is the other approach where you would just record your actions as you're clicking through. I'm actually not recording right now. I'm just getting to the point within the application that I want to validate. And what I'll do is I'll take this little crosshair down here, and I'll drag and drop it onto that text box. And so this is the control I want to validate. The property that I want to validate is the text property. We'll make sure that that's set equal to 1. One of the nice things that that they added in this release is the ability to add a message on assertion failure. In the past, when you created coded UI tests and an assertion failed, it would say, you know, foo is not equal to bar. But as a tester that's diagnosing a failed test, you don't necessarily know what that means. And so what you can do is you can say quantity is wrong. And then that way, in the test results, when it fails, it'll tell the tester what that means. So I can say validate quantity, and we'll add that. It's going to generate the new code as an assertion. I'll clean up my test application. Now, if I ran that right now, it would pass, trust me. But what I'm going to do instead is I'm actually going to change the data a little bit so that it fails, just to make it a little bit more interesting. So we'll say, you know, what happens if we enter the value of 5 there? Well, obviously, clicking on 5 is a valid value for a shopping cart, so it's not going to revert back to 1 at the end, but we're expecting it to go back to 1. So this should pass for 3 iterations, and then it should fail for the 4th iteration, just so you can see what that looks like. The build takes a few seconds on this machine, so if you have other questions, feel free to shout at me here. Yeah, the data binding was there in 2010 as well. So you have a few different options for the data binding. With this experience in 2010, it would also go back to that test parameters column from the manual test case. Or if you were to create a new test case, say, from scratch, then in 2010, we actually gave you a nice wizard that allows you to go back and say, I want to bind this to a CSV file, to a database, to an XML file. Unfortunately, currently, that wizard is gone in Visual Studio 2012 because they did a bunch of overhauling of the test logic in here. So they plan to add it back, but currently you would have to hand code that particular attribute. And there's an MSDN article. It's not as scary as it sounds once you figure out the kind of format for it. So it just ran the first iteration. It's going a lot slower when I'm on stage than it does in the speaker room, I promise. Usually goes pretty fast. The nice thing about this is you can put this on a build machine, or you can put this on a lab management environment, as I'll show you towards the end here. And then you can just run it overnight, and then that way you can come in the morning and you could say, here's my failed test, let me diagnose those failed tests and see what happened. So that one should fail. There we go. So it failed. And then if I select that test, you'll notice that we actually automatically include this PNG file from the failure. So you can see exactly what happened on the screen, which is also nice. You can do this in a build lab as well, or a lab managed environment. So as a tester who comes in here and diagnoses this issue, I see a screenshot of exactly what's going on. I also see that this particular assertion failed, so we expected 1, it was actually 5, and there's my message that I typed back to the tester to give them a little bit more context into what failed. So there's a lot of stuff you can do with coded UI tests. I have another session where I kind of show how you can capture a PNG file at every step along the way, and that's really nice for you to go back and look over the course of a full coded UI test run and say, you know, this page, I'm not adding validation logic here, but it just doesn't look right, or it doesn't render correctly on this operating system or this browser combination. So there's a lot of stuff you can do here. In the interest of time, I'm now going to switch back over to Microsoft Test Manager. And if coded UI tests are interesting, definitely go to Eric's talk later this week. So the next thing that I want to show you is testing Windows 8 applications with Microsoft Test Manager, because we did a lot of work in this scenario. Because when you're building an application for a tablet, You don't necessarily want to have the Microsoft Test Manager docked along the side of your tablet because you really expect to have that full screen real estate. You want to use the application exactly how the developer intended it to be used, which is full screen and with all the being able to slide back and forth and that kind of thing. And so what I can do is I'm going to run this particular test case, but instead of running it on my local machine, I'm going to run it on this tablet right here. I'll just make sure my connectivity is still working. Please, please, please. Yes, it is. All right. And now what I'll do is I'll go ahead and run that particular test. And you won't be able to see my tablet. And that's just because I don't have it outputting in anything from here. But actually, that's kind of interesting to think about. Because let's say that you're a developer, and I'm a tester, and I'm testing your application on this tablet. I could try to explain to you what I did. You know, I kind of did a pinch zoom, and then I dragged over here, and then I clicked on that, and then I triple-clicked, and I used three fingers, and I kind of spun it around, and it broke. That doesn't necessarily convey really well. But let me show you the experience that you get with this testing experience. So it actually knows, and it's telling me up here, that the testing session has started and my actions are being recorded. Over on the left-hand side, you'll see that it's telling me to open up the finance application. It's just the default finance application if any of you have Windows 8 installed. And it's telling me to look at the Microsoft stock ticker. So I'm going to do that right now. I'm just clicking through the application, trust me. And then there's Microsoft. The stock is down. I don't like that. And what it's doing is it's telling me to look at all the different time ranges. So I'm looking at 1 year, 5 years, all. It's kind of depressing. I should have joined a long, long time ago. But for all intents and purposes, this application at this point looks correct with the Microsoft stock ticker. But as testers, we want to try to break stuff. So I'll go ahead and pass this one. But I'll look at the next iteration of data. And the next iteration of data, if you notice here, it's actually asking me to run the same test case, but with the Facebook stock ticker. And what's interesting about that is, of course, Facebook is brand new on the market. And so we may not expect to see the same results as we go from day to week to month to year. And so I'm doing the same thing. Day looks fine, week looks fine, month looks fine, unless you're a shareholder, of course. Year looks okay. It's a little bit blocky. I think actually year is potentially a bug. And at this point, I really want to show the tester or the developer exactly what I'm seeing on my tablet. So I'm capturing a screen capture, and it's grabbing exactly what's on my tablet here. And I'm going to go ahead and fail that particular test step. 1 year looks blocky. If I look at 5 years, it's actually even worse. So that's what it looks like. We'll fail that one as well. 5 years is really blocky. And anyone want to guess? If we look at all, it's actually non-existent. This is a real application in Windows 8. I know it's impossible to think that Microsoft ever ships bugs, but this is an actual bug, I promise you. So it's a feature, that's right. You should be in marketing. So this range is totally empty. And so at this point, I'm going to go ahead and file a bug. So I'll create a bug. So time ranges for Facebook fail. I'll sign it to myself. And then down here, notice that we already have the test case that's captured. So as a developer looking at this, I can see exactly what the tester was trying to do. I can take a look at any one of these screenshots. And the best part, wait for it, is if I look at this action log down here, this rich action log, it takes just a second to load on this machine, shows exactly what I was doing throughout the entire context of that testing session. In fact, if you look at the text here, it says I tapped there. I think I slid somewhere. Now, I guess I didn't do any sliding, but if you do sliding, if you do pinch and zoom, it'll actually reflect that in the action log. So now when I'm going back to Martin, I'm saying, hey, your finance app is busted. I don't have to get creative as a tester with respect to how I describe exactly what I was doing. In fact, if I wanted to, I could have captured an entire video recording and audio test, audio recording of that particular session. So as I'm like using his app, I can be yelling at it, and he can really get the point about why it's broken. The other thing you'll notice here is that we automatically capture things like system information. So here you can see that's the machine name. I'm running the Windows 8 release preview. There's how much RAM I had. So again, let's just reduce that bug ping pong that goes back and forth and just tell the developer exactly what they need to know about this application. Yeah?
When you're doing the audio recording, mm-hmm. Are you using the tablet or the PC?
Yeah, when you're doing the audio recording, it's using the tablet in this case. Yeah. Yeah, good question. So that's Windows 8 testing. Now let's switch gears for a little bit, and we'll talk about lab management. So lab management is a really nice piece of functionality that we introduced in 2010. I think I mentioned that earlier. And at its core, lab management helps you set up what are called build, deploy, test workflows. The idea is simple. I make a change in my code. I want to see what that looks like in the environments that I need to test on. So in order to do that, think about what you need to do today. You need to go requisition a machine, get it to some state where you've got your prerequisites installed, then you push out your binaries. Maybe that's a SQL script, maybe that's an MSI. You get that all installed. At that point, you can start running through your tests. But that whole process is something that takes a long, long time today, and it's something that a lot of you have probably automated, but the automation typically tends to be something that can be somebody's full-time job just to maintain that entire automation rig. And so we wanted to make that a lot easier for you to work with. And in 2010, we did this by allowing you to use Team Foundation Server coupled with the workflow engine within Team Foundation Build. And then what we do is we actually layer on top of System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So this gets a little convoluted here, but bear with me. At the core, we have Team Foundation Server. Then we have three different controllers. One is the test controller, one is Team Build, and then we have System Center Virtual Machine Manager, which is responsible for managing all of the virtual machines across one or more physical machine, right? So the idea is I need to have a new SQL Server VM spun up. Here's my library where it's coming from, and deploy it out to some spare hardware. System Center Virtual Machine Manager takes care of the rest at that point. And so what we did is we layered on top of that by building in these concepts known as virtual environments, which consist of one or more virtual machines. And that virtual machine might be Windows Server 2008 for your web server, and then Windows 7 for a client machine that you want to test with IE9 on it or something like that. And in 2010, we had a kind of complex infrastructure with test agents that have to get wired up to test controllers, build agents that get wired up to build controllers, lab agents that get wired up to TFS as well. And it was kind of a nightmare to build and configure all this stuff. Once you get it set up, it's outstanding. I mean, you can literally make a change to some code over here. A few minutes later, it's running on multiple different environments. You can run your automated tests in those environments, and you quickly know whether or not anything failed. And then you have manual testers that can then use these environments to start running their manual tests. The other beauty of this is that because they're virtual environments, if you find a bug, you just snapshot the entire environment. When you file the bug, you include a link to that snapshot, so then when Martin looks at that bug and he starts to diagnose it, he can open that up and he can see the exact environment where that bug was discovered. The other nice thing you can do is you can use that to just revert back to some clean state, or you can take a snapshot after you deploy the build but before you run your tests, and you can always go to Friday night's build, for example. You may have heard in the keynote, ING Direct uses this. So they can press a button and they can get their entire banking infrastructure up in a lab management environment. Xbox Live uses this as well. So they can make a change to the way that achievements or leaderboards work. They can press a button, and then I think 30 to 60 minutes later, they've got an entire environment that's provisioned. They can run all their automated tests, and then they can let their playtesters come in there and start using the Xbox dev kits to say whether or not they've surfaced any bugs in that environment. So it's a really, really nice experience. But as I mentioned, the setup can be a real bear to actually go through and deploy all of this. And we heard that feedback from customers, and in Team Foundation Server 12, we introduced a new environment type called a standard environment. We still have these SCVMM environments, and as you'll see, those are the way that you would get all the functionality I mentioned, including one I didn't mention, which is network fencing, which is if I need to have a true replica of my production server environment, maybe I need to have five replicas of that environment. I maybe want to have the same IP addresses, same machine names. Network fencing allows you to do that on the same physical network infrastructure without having collisions amongst that. And so SCVMM environments support that. But there may be cases where I want to use third-party virtualization. Maybe I don't want to use System Center Virtual Machine Manager. Maybe I just have, as George and I were talking earlier, maybe I just have a Windows Server environment, and my dev box is Windows 8, but I've got Windows Server running on VirtualBox or running on an old dev machine under my desk. Wouldn't it be nice if I could set up that dev machine so that I could just check code into TFS and then a few minutes later see whether or not I introduced any regressions or just see if it runs on Windows Server? And so that's where standard environments come in. They don't have this whole infrastructure that you saw in the previous slide. You can basically just point at any machine that you have access to, and it doesn't matter if it's running a physical machine or VMware. We'll go out and we'll provision it with the agent, single agent in this release, and automatically wire it up to your test controller, build controller, and so on. So in the time we have remaining, let me show you what that looks like. So in this virtual machine, I've actually already created an environment that we're going to work with just because it takes a little while, about 15 minutes, to stage a new environment. But I'll go ahead and kick off a new environment so you can see what that process looks like. When you create a new environment, you get two options. One is just the standard environment. If I had SCVMM configured, I would have that option as well. I don't have an SCVMM environment with me, so I don't have that. It's grayed out. But let's say that the new environment I want to add is Windows Server 2008 plus SQL Express. Actually, I don't know if I can use a plus sign, so I'll just say and. And the other machine that's running over here is called, I always forget it, ALM Lab Guest. So we'll add that machine. We'll give it a role, which in a single machine environment doesn't really matter. If you had multiple machines, you sometimes want to say, this is my web server, this is my database server, this is my client. I'll give it the name of the password that has the rights to deploy the agent to. The other thing I can do is if I'm going to run coded UI tests in that environment, I need to tell it the name of an account that can run in an interactive mode. And so if I needed to test as Brian, I would want to give it those credentials so that it could log into the corporate network resources and whatever and basically simulate as if it was me. I'm not going to configure this for coded UI tests, so I'll skip that for now. And then I'll just say verify. And now what it's doing is it's making sure it has access to that machine, it's making sure that the credentials worked, and then it's going to, in the next step, go out, install the agent that's required, and automatically wire that up to the test controller and build controller and so on. And so that's really nice. You don't have to worry about the infrastructure nearly as much as you used to in 2010. So I'll finish that. It'll go off and do its thing. But I'm going to use this environment for now just because it's already set up and ready to go. So let me show you just the places I've already configured this. In my test plan, I went in here and I said that I need a test setting that defines exactly what I'm going to collect off of each one of those machines in the environment. And I have a single machine here, but if I had an N-tier architecture, I could say off my database server, I want to collect an event log. Off of my web server, I want to collect an IntelliTrace file. And off of my client machine, where I'm running coded UI tests to simulate a web browser session, I want to capture a video recording. So whatever you want to capture there, you can define that. And that way, if you find a bug, it automatically captures those diagnostics. I also created a new environment here, a new test configuration, I mean, which basically defines the different environments that I'm testing in. And then when I come back to my test plan, I already have a test case which has automation associated with it, which means that I went into Visual Studio, I created a unit test or a coded UI test, any kind of automated test, and then I went into that test case and I said, this is the test that now runs that particular test case in an automated fashion. And so it started off as a manual test, and now it's an automated test. And I just need to come in here and make sure that it's configured to run in that particular configuration now. So I'm now going to test my code on Windows Server, so I need to tell the test plan that. At that point, I think, unless I've forgotten anything, I can now jump into Visual Studio, which is where I'll configure my build definition. And this is what actually defines exactly what happens when I build my code, I deploy it out to this environment, and then I run these tests. The first thing you'll have is just your traditional team build project where you typically build your code today if you're using team build. And so what I'll do just to save us some time is I'll go ahead and kick off a new build. And that build is going to contain my application code, my database code, anything that I'm going to deploy as part of that payload. The only thing I'm doing is I'm disabling tests because I don't want to run my tests on my build machine. Instead, I want to run those on the lab managed environment machine. So now I'll queue that. That'll go off and build that particular code. And now what I'll do is create a new build definition. I'll call it Windows Server 2008 R2 SQL 2008 R2. Trigger, you can make this every night or every check-in if you wanted to. Some of these you can skip right past. And then this is the really interesting bit here. So most of the time, if you've worked with team build and TFS before, you just select the default template and away you go. But if you're doing lab management, you actually want to select this lab management template. And then you want to scroll down until you see this ellipsis on the first row, and you click that, and what that'll do is it'll basically launch this wizard that asks you, okay, what are you actually building and deploying and testing? Here's the environment that I want to use. It's the one that's already ready. Notice that if I was running an SCVMM environment, I could tell it to revert back to a specific snapshot, but because I'm running a standard environment, we don't have the hooks into that. So if you were running this on VMware, for example, there's nothing preventing you from scripting some additional logic that says roll back to some known state within that VMware environment. It's just that the build environment itself doesn't necessarily know how to do that out of the box. Next, I will decide what I want to deploy. Remember, I already kicked this off, so I'll just use the latest successful build from that compilation build. At this point, I can decide what I want to deploy. And basically, I just go through this grid and say for each machine in that environment, run this script, or xcopy this set of binaries, or MS deploy, or web deploy, or whatever technology you're using today, this is where you script it. The nice thing about this is that it will actually return any failures and the whole status, just like a command console output, that'll be returned right within your build script. So if you have a problem during the deployment phase, you'll be able to go back and look at that log and understand what's going on. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip this just because I've already deployed my build earlier to that environment. And then finally, what do I want to test? So this is my particular test plan. I want to test with this particular configuration, saying this is a Windows Server environment, so anytime you run these tests, store it in TFS against that particular row of the test matrix. And if I've done that all correctly, I should be able to kick off a build now. So remember, this one's going to go pretty fast just because I don't need to roll back. I've already got the code deployed. I'm just running my tests at this point. But the steps are the same if you were to do this for a quote-unquote real environment. And so here you can see it's kicking off that particular build. And you can follow the status. The other nice thing that you can do here, if you're using TFS 2012, is you can actually see the build status right within TFS Web Access. This is an old build. It looks much better now if you saw the foundational earlier. And here you can see my queued builds. I can actually queue a build from the Web Access interface now, which is nice. I don't have to be at my Visual Studio workstation. And here you can see that it's running my tests. Tends to refresh. There we go. So it finished up running that particular build. If I look at the build details, you'll see where the test ran. If I look at those test results, it's going to open up the full set of test results right within Microsoft Test Manager. And if there were any attachments, any test failures, this is where I would come to diagnose those. So if I turned on video, for example, I could go back and look at the video at this point. So that's lab management, and I've done other presentations before where I go through the setup of an SCVMM environment. I won't have time for that today, but hopefully you see a different way of how you might be able to get quickly started with with standard environments, and there's nothing preventing you from then turning around and saying, I want to do more later on with an SCVMM environment. I have just a few more slides just to wrap up, and I like to talk about this guy, Lord Kelvin. And he was famous for quoting or for saying, you cannot manage what you cannot measure. Of course, he invented the Kelvin scale. But I think that I like to call him the grandfather of TFS because that's kind of our mantra as well. You know, software development is a very complex process. There's lots of moving parts. There's lots of things happening. And until you can actually grasp what an individual project is looking like over time, it's difficult as a project leader or as a manager or just a team member to understand, if I move this lever, here's how something changes. Here's how code quality changes. And so that's why we really tie all this stuff together for you with TFS and having those built-in reports. This is one of my favorite reports. I call this the Steven Sinofsky Report. The reason I call this the Steven Sinofsky Report, you might know that Steven Sinofsky is the president of the Windows division. He used to be the president of the Office division. Both of those products, Windows 7 and Office 2010, were built using an early build of TFS 2010, where we first started introducing this work item hierarchy concept and the ability to have rich hierarchy relationships between work items. And so if you see a report like this, you can actually look at an individual user story or feature that you care about. And then as an executive that's looking at this project, I can see, well, this is how much of the project is done. This is how much has been implemented. And that may make me feel pretty good about where the code's at. But I also have this other dimension over here that tells me, you know, my test plan is not really progressing very well. I have a lot of tests that are failing. I have some features that don't even have any tests written against them. And so that's why it's important to be able to look at these multi-dimensional views, and we try to give that to you whenever possible. So this is an out-of-the-box report that you get if you use TFS and you start to use all these functionality together. I'm going to skip through some of these. I just wanted to include them in my slide deck. This is another example that I like to point out. You can see in the upper left, this is a task burndown. If all I have as a metric on my team is a task burndown, I might feel pretty good about this project. It seems like we're on a good trajectory to finish this by the end of, I don't know, next week or whenever that is. But if I then look at this other dimension down here, this user story progress, it doesn't look so good. That blue section of the graph indicates code that's still active or user stories that are still active. The yellow section indicates user stories that the dev team says are done, but the test team needs to validate, or maybe the customers need to do their acceptance testing against. And the green, of which, of course, there's no green up here, indicates work that's done, work that's signed off. And so at this current trajectory, what it looks like is my dev team is maybe doing a little work over here, a little work over there, a little work over there. They're kind of skipping around. They're not really focusing on closing out user stories, which is what we need to do to give us a confidence that the quality of these user stories is going to be locked down before we have to turn around and hand it off to our customer at the end of the iteration. So just a few examples. Like I said, it's in my slide deck, so you can take a look at more of them. As I mentioned in the foundational session, you can go out and download the release candidate. You can use this for a go-live environment. You can start using the Team Foundation Service preview that Martin's going to talk about next. We also announced this morning that there will be a free version of the preview. We haven't announced exactly how free breaks down versus paid. We'll do that later. We're still working through some of those details. But it's a really exciting time. There's never been an easier way to get started with Team Foundation Server, whether you're running on-premises or in the cloud. My virtual machine is up there. It's available on my blog. That's an aka.ms short link that actually goes to that direct download. Of course, catch us at Ask the Experts and the TLC area. And I already talked about that. TFSpreview.com is the URL. And I'll keep these in my slide deck, and I'll keep them up if you want to see more ALM sessions. So I'm going to get out of the way so that I can let Martin come set up, but I will stick around if there's any questions. Thank you for coming to this session. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope to see you the rest of the week.